trust it'll be a great time. It was a wonderful time of singing music and last week, and look forward to our time together again this evening. When I look at the text in front of me, I'm not going to have you stand because I want to talk about this with you, and it's a very sensitive topic. If you'd like to follow along with me, in your bulletin is a sheet of paper, a half sheet of paper, that I have given you some notes. I will not necessarily follow those verbatim, but that's going to give you something that you can refer to, because I may refer back and forth to them every now and then. And of course, on the back, you can write some thoughts if you would like to do that. But I'd like to speak to you today in a way that I've never sliced this passage before, but a way that the Lord, I think, is leading me in this way. And that is this. When I look at the way the Apostle Paul writes Titus in chapter 2, he begins with two categories of people that are extremely important to the church, maybe foundational. I call them directional members of the church. Look at the first three verses. But as for you, Paul writes, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine, that the older men be sober, fervent, temperate, sound in faith, love, and patience. The older women, likewise, reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. First part of verse 4, that they admonish the young women. ... There are six categories of people listed here for church members, but he begins with the older men, older women. Look what he says in verse 2. The older men be. You see that in the text? The older men be. There's not a verb that way in verse 3, though in some of your translations it's there, but the term likewise is found in verse number 3. The older women likewise. The idea is you also be. So that when I come to this thought in my mind as I'm working through the book of Titus, I'm just trying to think, how in the world would this have hit the early readers and the early listeners to the book of Titus? The first group of people that are mentioned here are the older men and the older women. Now, if I were to ask you, how many of you fit this category? I wonder how many of you would actually respond. How many people here are over 100? Let me see your hands. Okay, so that's for them. So you can rest easy. Is that what you're thinking? Well, I don't think so. I think that as you look at, you've heard of the Hippocratic Oath. Well, he also had a way to lay out ages, and I gave that to you on the very first point on your paper that's there in front of you, how Hippocrates laid out the stages of life. Infancy was 0 to 7 years old. A child is 8 to 14. A youth is 15 to 21. Young adults, 22 to 28. A man was 29 to 49, an elder, 50 to 56, and the geros, which is an interesting Greek term. It means the prize or the reward. Anything over 56 is a reward. And so when you think of the way he laid it out, I think in all probability he's thinking those around in the 50 category and up. Now, I'm not going to say exactly at 50. It could be I'm 53, so he might be thinking 55 and older, okay? But in all due respect, I think he's thinking about those around the 50 age bracket. These are considered those who are in the elder generation. These are the older. And let me say to you, men and women, it's highly significant for us as a church that we have an intergenerational church. And you see that here in these 10 verses, older women and older men and younger women and the pastor, and he even includes the slaves. This is an intergenerational church, and it's an inter-economic church as well, because you have the slaves as well as the free men. Because church is made up of every single walk of life. And whenever there is a segmenting of society away from the rest of the body is going to hurt, the body is going to suffer. It is a joy for me yesterday to come in, as Matt Campbell said, to come in and see those people in there working. And there were those with gray hair or no hair, and those who were in middle school, the whole spectrum of those putting together these evangelism packets. Or is this morning to be able to look into the chapel and see that chapel just jam-packed with people, with the Berean class and the teens. I mean, it was a wonderful experience for me just to look through and then to hear them sing the songs. You know, I say to you, men and women, intergenerational church is significant, and this is why I'm afraid when I see churches that say, well, we're called to reach the rich, or we're called to reach the yuppie kind of person, or we're called to reach the younger. And so they'll segment it with their music. They segment it with so many different areas of in their church so that somehow they are hitting a target area where in the book of Titus in chapter 2, everyone is to be hit in the church. The older to the younger, the free as well as the slave. Economics do not matter and the generations do not matter. They need to be seen as part of the whole. So when I come to the older generation, one of the concerns that I have is that we are hearing more and more of men who are to retire early in life. Some of them are forced retirements. I understand that. But I am talking about more and more is to reduce that age so that now you can have time for yourself. And I would just say to you, I'm not certain that this is going to accomplish what we need to accomplish. Already, our work week is not like it was in the first century. And now we are seeing things happen that greatly concern me as a pastor. It was interesting to me that my son gave to me a couple of quotes from John Piper's book, on desiring God. I just went through them last night. I went through a couple of his pages that he had written, and he deals with this issue of retirement, and he quotes Ralph Winter, and Ralph Winter makes this statement, most men don't die of old age, they die of retirement. I read somewhere, still quoting, I read somewhere that half of the men retiring in the state of New York die within 2 years. Save your life and you'll lose it. Just like other drugs, other psychological addictions, retirement is a virulent disease, not a blessing. J. Campbell White writes these words, and I quote, most men are not satisfied with their permanent output of their lives. Nothing can wholly satisfy the life of Christ within his followers except the adoption of Christ's purpose toward the world he came to redeem. Fame, pleasure, riches are all but husks and ashes in contrast with the boundless, abiding joy of working with God in fulfillment of his eternal plan. The men who are putting everything into Christ's undertaking are getting out of it the sweetest and most priceless of rewards. You see, I'm not saying that, okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to, as you are thinking of retiring at age 52 or 55, that now I want you to give X amount of time to the church. No, I just came across the website. Our staff is doing a strategic plan for our church over these next couple of months and came across the website from a church. And this church in another state, another denomination, is telling its people, we want you, every church member, to commit at least 2% of your life for this year to short-term missions. You keep the other 98%, but give 2% of your life to short-term missions. And if you give 2% of your life to short-term missions, it will enhance the other 98% of your life. And I thought in reading through that, I said, that's tremendous. That is exactly where we need to be. We're talking about people who are willing to give of their life. I'm not talking to you about giving more money. I'm not talking about that you've got to come to church every time the doors open. I'm just talking about investing your life in Christ. What would Jesus want you to do? What is the direction he wants to take you? And I'm concerned because we live in a day and an age where the society of the older is a society that has become benign in the church. And it should be very powerful in the church. It should be very strong within our church. And I have given to you on that sheet of paper just how the Old Testament views old age, and I will not go through that. It's there for you. You can look at it. And it views the glory of gray hair and wisdom. In fact, the reason that the children of Israel divided, as I have for you here, is because King Rehoboam in 1 Kings 12, he didn't listen to the elders. And so because he didn't listen to the elders, it divided 10 tribes up north, 2 tribes down south. And that's the way it stayed. You see, we need the gray hairs of the elders as we need the strong legs of the younger. It's not either or, it's both and. And this is the way the church must move together. I treasure the thoughts of those who have gray hair, especially, as it says in Proverbs, when their gray hair is in righteousness and not bitterness. I treasure that. I would say to you, I hold in my hand a book. I have not read this book. I've just gone through it. Number of chapters here. It's called Ambushed at Sunset, Coping with Mature Adult Temptations. It's in our library. And it's interesting because the back, the people who wrote are people that I respect. Warren Wiersbe, others like that, have written concerning this. So I got this book out just this week because I've been thinking, what does our bookstore have to say about old people? I'd be interested to know. So I went in and grabbed a bunch of books and took them home and went through a number of books. This is one of Ambushed at Sunset. It's a stirring title. It's about how people who are 50 years old and above are going to face temptations. And as I was thinking about that, my mind went to the scriptures, and that's why you have number 3 on your sheet of paper. My mind went through the scriptures, and I just began going through men who are ambushed at sunset. Men that have a great life and have a powerful life and a powerful testimony, but things happen in their life when they got a little older, and it really caused a disruption. It really caused a disjunction. It really caused challenges. And when you look at Noah, for instance, here, 3 of his kids and his family is saved going through this incredible experience of the flood. But because of wine and pleasure, Noah finds himself without his clothes on, and Ham laughing at his dad and making jokes of his dad, and his dad turning around when he comes back to his senses and cursing Ham and the children to follow. I mean, the very people that were rescued through the ship, now we've got an incredible divide in the family. Why? Because dad got drunk and dad took his clothes off. You move to Lot, not too far away, and you come to a most incredible and horrid story of how Lot fathers 2 children by his 2 daughters. This is a guy who made consistent, poor decisions. But if you turn all the way back to chapter 13 of Genesis, you will see where his decision-making was always with the eye gate. Wow, I can have any place I can go. Abraham, you really mean this? Okay, let's divide this way. I'll take this land over here. And by the way, it's the grassiest and most beautiful land. Happens to be next to Sodom and Gomorrah, but it's the most beautiful of land, and Abram, you got that over there. And Abram looks, and it looks barren. I mean, the way that Lot made decisions, I would say to you men and women that we probably would not even know that Lot is a Christian, a believer, a truthful, committed one to Yahweh God, unless it was not for the New Testament, where it says in Peter that Lot's soul, his righteous soul, was vexed with all of the challenges around him. Except for that phrase, just reading 13 to 19 of Genesis, we'd never know Lot was a believer. I mean, he lived like the world, and living like the world had incredible repercussions on his kids. I mean, he lost some of them to Sodom and Gomorrah. They were killed. And then the other 2, he had children by him. You know, is this, you know, how do we make decisions? This is after his children are grown and married, all but 2. You work your way through Jacob and how Jacob stands before Pharaoh with Joseph at the end of the book of Genesis. And there he compares himself. He says, my days, 132, they're nothing but evil days. And I don't even compare with my father's. Wow, you stop and look how God protected and blessed this guy. But this guy can't get it out of his mind. I don't have as much as they did. Jacob is a guy who never enjoyed what God gave him. I think of Moses, who was over 100 years old. And he's just tired in Numbers 20 of all of this stuff going on around him. And they don't have water. And so God says, go speak to the rock. And so he goes to the rock and he speaks not to the rock. He speaks to the people. And he says, you bunch of rebels, here's your water. And he takes his rod and he strikes it twice. And God says, okay, you're not going into the promised land for that. We say, that's pretty sharp. Psalms 106 has a very interesting commentary on that. It says this, because Moses spoke ill-advisedly with his lips. He's in his hundreds. Because his speech was improper, he was not able to go into the promised land. You see, we're talking about men who were well over 50 years of age. We're talking about men, Jacob, 132 years old. Abraham and Sarah, that's an interesting one. And the sin of discontent can come into the generation of those who are 50 years and older because they'll look back at their life and they say, I just haven't done what I really dreamed. Or they'll look at their life and compare it with somebody else, maybe somebody in the church, maybe somebody, a high school friend, maybe a college friend, maybe a neighbor, it could be anyone, and all of a sudden discontent creeps in. And as it begins to creep in, it's going to be exactly a prototype as we see with Abraham and with Sarah in chapter number 16. Abraham at that point is 85 years old. 10 years earlier, he had left and he had followed God's plan. And God said, I'm going to give you lots of children. 10 years later, he's got no children. And so finally Sarah comes to him and said, here's the problem. The problem is God has done this to us. And so here you take my Egyptian and you have children by her. We've got to have kids here. And so here, this is the best way that I can possibly think of. And God does not speak. God just lets it play out. And because of the discontent of Abraham and Sarah and blaming God for what has happened in the last years of their life, last decades of their life, the next thing you know, you've got the Ishmaelites and you know the story. You see, these are sins that face us in a powerful way, those of us who have come through the first five decades of life, the sin of pleasure and wine, the sin of poor decisions, the sin of comparing ourselves with others, the sin of improper speech, the sin of discontent, and yes, the sin of immoral lust. David's probably early 50s, Bathsheba early 20s. She has no children. And you know the story that takes place there in 2 Samuel chapter 11, 2 Samuel 11. You know the story that's there because David's eyes just were wandering. I mean, and God said to David a little bit later, David, if it was another wife, why couldn't you have asked me? Look how many I've given you. You see, the eyes of man are never satisfied like Sheol, and destruction are never full. It becomes acute when you sit and you look back and you say, wow, I just not where I thought I would be. The older generation must also face the Solomonic issue, and that's this, that we can be very wise in our earlier years and act very foolish in our last years. And the reason is because there's a rejection of God's word. There's a turning against. God said, now, don't do this, don't do this, and don't do this. And before you know it, you begin to read in Kings, and he's got his horses, and he's got his gold and his silver, and he's got his hundreds of wives. Those are the three things God said, don't do that as a king. Deuteronomy 17. Rejection of God's word. Zechariah, there's another one, how your New Testament opens, and he is to be the father of John the Baptist. And so here he stands, and he is doing his thing as a priest. And then Gabriel just appears to him, who comes from the presence of God, and says to him, Zechariah, this is what God's going to do. And Zechariah didn't say, great. Zechariah said, I don't believe it. And so what did the angel do? He said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. You're going to be mute until the birth of this boy, because you didn't believe God. You see, he's in the twilight of his years, but he's having a hard time dealing with the issue of faith, trusting God. Because all of his life, he's been able to trust what he sees. And what he sees, he's not been happy with. He's not had a child. His wife is barren. He's going to be faithful to her. And he's going to do what God has called him to do as a priest. But he's just not real happy. And when God sends his angel to him to say, this is what's going to happen, Zechariah says, nah, not going to happen. It's interesting to me that when Mary comes into the door and she comes face to face with Zacharias' wife Elizabeth, she gives this incredible statement. And the last words of her statement are this: "Blessed are you because you have believed in the Lord." Here's a 16-year-old, 14, 15, 16-year-old girl who believes God. Here's Zachariah the priest who has served God for decades, but he just can't believe. He can't really believe it. Trusting God. So when I look at these things that are here in front of me, men and women, I'm just challenging us. I just wanted to set the table for us today, because God has called the older men and the older women to the church, and he's not called you to be partial members. He's not called you to be sub-members. He's called you to come to this church and provide the leadership that is needed, but that leadership is going to have to follow certain qualifications, and there's four for the older men, and there's four for the older women. Look at the text and see what they are. It says for the older men, they are to be. That's so powerful to me. Let me just say this to you, men and women, that to be these things is a battle, and to be these things is a challenge, but to be these things is a calling. God has called you to do this. He has not called you to sit on the sidelines and just let his church just sort of march on, and I sure hope the young guys really make the right decision. I don't think so. You know, we there's so many people that, you know, I'm not against traveling. I'm not against doing things and having things and all those kinds of things. I'm not against all of that, but the focus are we to have? If I live my family and my family like some people live in the church, I mean, nobody even know I have a family. So I think it's important that the older men and the older women are the first two categories, and they just leap out here on at us from the text. And the older men are to be sober. They are to be clear thinkers. The original word here, nephthalion, it means to be, to abstain from alcohol. That's how the word initially meant in the Greek language. But it sort of developed along lines so that the emphasis more was being clear-headed, without intoxication, and to be clear-headed. And that's the term that's used, to be sober, to be clear-headed, to be sound. It involves a general restraint from indulging in my natural desires. You see, somebody who is 50 and above is usually will have less expenses because their kids now are out. Not always. But usually they'll have less expenses. Some of the kids or all the kids are out of the home. And some of them are at a place in their job where they don't necessarily have to be there all the time. And so there's lots of different things. And so they're getting more time on their hand. They're able to do more thinking. They're able to do more spending. And so there must be a general restraint. It must be clear thinking. It includes having a balanced view of yourself. One of the most incredible statements I came across this week was from Martin Luther as he talked about the destructive thinking of a 60-year-old. This is how Martin Luther in 1500 put it, and I'm putting in, of course, English here. Young men are tempted by girls. Men who are 30 are tempted by gold. Men who are 40 are tempted by honor and glory. But those who are 60 are tempted when they say to themselves, "What a pious man I have become." It's interesting to me when I look at this term, nephthalion, in the Greek, it is translated sober here. You only find it three times in the New Testament in this way. It's interesting to me. It's found here in 1 Timothy chapter 3, we won't turn to it, but in 1 Timothy chapter 3, you find it as a qualification for a bishop. And then when you move down in 1 Timothy chapter 3, you find it as a qualification for a deacon's wife. And then the third time that you find it is right here in Titus in chapter 2, where it says, okay, now I not only want these select individuals in the church to do it, but I want every older man in all of the church to act like he is a bishop with his life. He is to be a clear thinker. Secondly, the text says in Titus 2, he's to be reverent. reverent. Samnos is an interesting term, to be reverent. At the very core of this term is what you find it when you find it in Philippians 4:8. Whatever things are honest, same term. At the very core of this term, to be reverent, at the very heart of it, is a heart of honesty. See, over the years, we can build up walls and we can build up sort of a plastic society around us. But at the very core of who we are as older men is that we must be reverent, meaning our lives at the very core have to be committed to honesty. Care is the idea of trustworthiness and dignity found in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2. Same word, same idea. Just men who are men of dignity, honesty, respect. The church must be able to look at the older generation and feel secure. The women in the church need to come into the church and feel secure. The children in the church need to come in and feel secure. Because they look around at the gray hair that has been following righteousness, and these are honest men. So when I put money in an offering plate, I have this incredible security that these men are honest. And they're not dipping into the offering and putting it into their pocket. And I can actually have this man teach my teens and know that nothing will take place that is inappropriate, because at the core of these individuals is they're men who are honest. Their doctrine is honest. The way they handle money is honest. The way they handle the opposite sex is honest. The way they teach children, it's honest. Everything about them, they just model Christian honesty and behavior. These are reverent men. Thirdly, they're temperate, the text says. Temperate is a really interesting term. It is used in two other places in Titus. It's used in chapter 1 and verse number 8, and this is a qualification for the pastor, the elder. It's also used in chapter 2 here in verse number 5, a qualification for a young woman. There it's used, discreet is the term there. The very first one in verse number 5 is the same term used for the older men in verse 2, only it's translated there temperate, but it's the same word. You see, there's a lot of interconnection taking place here. This word has a pretty large stretch when it comes to meaning. It can mean rational, purposeful, prudent, self-controlled, moderate, chastity. These are words that are significant words to describe what it means here in the text in verse number 2. They are to be temperate, and then young women are to be discreet. In Platonic thinking, it was a virtue to aspire to this, that your body and your mind are completely controlled by what is good and what is rational. And in the church, older men are to lead the way. So as older men lead the way, it's going to influence the younger women. Though they don't teach the younger women directly, as it says here in the text, yet their lifestyle is so powerful, it influences the younger women who are living in homes that want to follow Christ. The last one here is an interesting, it has three modifiers to it. It's healthy, sound in faith and love and patience. There's three modifiers. In other words, they're not sick. Spiritually, they're not sick. In faith, that's towards God. In love, towards others. And patience or perseverance, that's towards the Christian life. These are the three areas that these men are to show soundness in. That if you're over 50 years old, you're to show a soundness. That as you walk in faith towards God and you walk in love towards others in the body and you persevere in life, you're just not always up and down. I mean, these are powerful thoughts. It is no wonder to me that about every place you turn when it talks about older men, you'll come up with the poem with the bridge builder, will you not? And the bridge builder is a powerful poem because it's about this old man who is building a bridge, and somebody comes along and says, what are you doing? You're not going to pass this way again. And the old man says, that's true, I'm not. But there's going to be a fair-haired youth. He's coming, and if I don't build this bridge, he's going to fall in. And I like the way this works. as he speaks here in chapter 2. And I wonder if some of the commentators are not accurate in verse number 2 when they say, when you look at the way that this older man is to be, probably from this group, the actual elders of chapter 1 are going to be chosen. And I think that's probably a great way to see it. The elder has an idea of maturity and dignity, has an idea of protection. I see the older people in the church as an umbrella of protection so that we can look and say, hey, there is the product. I'm in the process right now, and it's hard. I mean, raising a two-year-old. And so I look there and I see, yeah, there's the product. There's a godly man or a godly older woman. I say, yeah, I can get there. Sometimes you might ask them, how do you get there? And they're not necessarily like James Dobson. James Dobson writes a book on the 17 ways to bring your two-year-old through the process. I mean, these guys were around before James Dobson was born, some of them. But it's not about having all the six keys and the seven links and the powerful this and the powerful that. And if you do this, you got this surefire thing that this is the way your kids are going to turn out. This is how you're going to turn out. There's nothing like that. What you need to see is a life that has been through life. And as this life has been through life, and you see the ages around the eyes, the wrinkles around the eyes. There is a temperament of the face. There is a playground on the face that comes from the soul that shows contentment with their God. And their lifestyle proves it. And you're drawn to that person. And you say, I've got to talk with them. That's why they're in the church. And if our godly older men and older women are not leading us, if you're not directing us, we're going to have a problem. We're going to have a church that turns upside down, and that's where we are in America today. It's interesting to me that he moves from the older men to the older women. And when he moves to the older women, I did a little research, and I typed in, and Googled, and up came an article that I'd never seen before. It comes from, I meant to check with John Sargent, I have to check with him afterwards. It comes from the Orthodox Church in Russia. I read this article, and I was just overwhelmed, because here was a guy, here's an Orthodox priest who has one foot in Russia and one foot in America, and he titled his article, which I read with just fascination, and the title of his article is this, Where Have All the Grandmas Gone? And this is his subtitle. Where Have All the Grandmas Gone? The Lost Influence of Older Women in the Life of the Church by Father John Weldon Hardin Brooke. I probably have never quoted from an Orthodox priest from this pulpit in my life. But let me just give you a couple of thoughts from him because of his perspective from Russia and America. Listen to these words. The godless communist dictator Joseph Stalin inadvertently touched upon one of the most formidable yet unheralded sources of power known to the Orthodox Church when Stalin made his now famous prophecy, quote, when the old women of Russia die, the church will die. This statement was recently noted in an American news anchorman speaking of the emerging strength of the Russian church and the collapse of communism. He said, quote, the truth of the matter is the old women of Russia just didn't die. Stalin knew that he could not kill the soul of the Orthodox Church in Russia without exterminating every pious old woman in the land. Even Stalin knew he couldn't get away with doing a thing like that. Most of those women had lost their husbands to World War II or to the evil and cruel persecution suffered in the hands of the Soviet butchers. However, no oppressor could win the war against these grandmothers, the babushkas. Did I do that right, John Sargent? Babushka. Okay, get my accent on the right syllable. Okay. These old women guarded the small eternal flame of the life of the church that was ever pressed by the gates of hell. They provided a living image of holiness for the younger women to follow. From this heritage came in later years a constant flow of strong, selfless, pious old women. The old women who never died because their faith had never died. My question is this, writes this man. My question is this: where are the faithful grandmothers in North America? Did these women somehow fail to immigrate to this land? Did their daughters and granddaughters get lost in the land of plenty and fail to pass on the spiritual life and the traditions of the church? Why aren't our women today maturing in the role that is so needed in our lives? In many Orthodox parishes throughout North America, grandma is gone. And I believe the church will not come to its fullness of healthy faith until we get her back. For God has given such women an incredible gift of strength to overcome even the most severe and cruel obstacles of life when it comes to the need for faith and courage to survive. The fabric of their life was formed from the warp and woof of personal hardship and endurance. These factors included: 1, a life of suffering; 2, the acceptance of suffering as not only inevitable but beneficial to their spiritual life; 3, the belief that self-sacrifice is integral and beautiful to the Christian life; and 4, they had a godly order of priorities. Let me conclude with this statement. The church in America may not be facing overt physical persecution, but she is facing something potentially much more harmful: the slow attrition in numbers and zeal brought about by constant contact with a godless society. The church in North America is in desperate peril. She is losing her young people at an alarming rate. Without strong, spiritual older women who are willing to give of themselves to teach younger women and to keep the tradition alive, the church will not survive. We need desperately need the return of pious, fearless, courageous, godly women to protect the interior life of the church and home. Paul wrote it this way: older women, be reverent in behavior, teachers of good things, admonish the young women, Titus 2, 3, and 4. No one has more experience and wisdom to pass on to a younger woman than an older woman. It is always tragic to come to a young mother who has gone through needless agony because she failed to understand this divine order or could not find an older woman who was willing to teach her. So when we look at the text that's here in front of us, I want us to be challenged by older women. What does it say? 3 things, real quickly. 3 things. 1, reverent in behavior. That is an interesting term. It's 2 terms. The word reverent is 2 terms made up, one of temple and the other is fitting. Fitting for the temple. It's an unusual term. Their behavior is fitting for the temple. It's the only time this word is ever found in the New Testament. One writer writes, this word means that older women take seriously the fact that they belong to God. In one sense, they're like Anna in Luke chapter 2, where she was night and day in the temple and she saw the Lord Jesus as an infant and gave praise. You see, when I see this here, it's interesting that this almost mirrors with the older men the word sober or reverent that's there. Almost mirrors it, but this heightens the term. These women move in and out of the church like a priest would move carefully in and out of the temple in that day. Secondly, they are not slanderers. See, this activity does not dignify a priest. These slanderers really comes from the Greek term diabolos. We get the word devil. They are devils. They are people who are not able to control their tongue. The tongue is to be the instrument of construction, not destruction. So they are not slanderers. Connected with that are those who live without boundaries, and they have too much wine. And that's the next statement. And I would just call your mind to remember Noah, the incredible experience of bringing his family through the flood, and because of his incredible decision-making process or lack thereof, he divides the family and curses the grandchildren. When I look at this statement here, protecting boundaries, just be very careful that talkativeness and intoxication are found in the very same framework, and both of them with a negative. Don't do this and don't do that. They are considered by God to be the same. You talk too much, it's like being intoxicated too much. They walk together. It says here, thirdly, that they are teachers, or fourthly, they are teachers of good things. I love this. This is, again, Paul created words. Here is a word that he created that's not found in the New Testament, teachers of good things. It's interesting, Paul, this word that he created is not for the pastor. This word that he created for teaching is not for men. The word that he created for teaching is for older women. And the word that he creates is powerful, that ladies are expected, the older ladies in the church are expected to be teachers of everything that is good, everything that has moral value. They are to be called, as Peter does in 1 Peter 3, daughters of Sarah. And why should they have these four things? Because the very next phrase, if you'll note here, the very next phrase says here in verse number 4, in order that they may admonish. And to me, again, it's very interesting to me, because if you have an English text in your hand, all of you have different translations of what, some of you that they may train the younger women, some of you that they encourage the younger women, some of you that they may admonish the younger women, but all three of those words are just an emphasis of the translation. Because neither of those come. The word train is the word down here in verse number 12, training us to say no. Paiduo. It's not that. The word encourage is the word to come alongside and encourage, like a paraclete, like the Holy Spirit. It's not that term. The word admonish is the word counsel, nutheteo. We get that term, nuthetic counseling. It's not that term. The term is absolutely impossible to translate. But here's what the idea is at the very bottom of your sheet, Gordon Fee, I put his statement from his commentary and I thought it was fantastic. He said, now these older women are to do these four things because they're to come alongside of the younger women and help them to wise up to all of their responsibilities that God has given to them. That's the only way you can understand what is here in verse 4a. As teachers of good things, as ladies who are keeping their tongue and their boundaries under control, as women who act like priests in a temple, they have the right to be able to go to the young women and to help the young women to wise up to their responsibilities that face them. When I thought about bringing this to a conclusion, and my time is done, in my studies this week, I came across the very first conference in the White House on aging. John F. Kennedy was the president. It was in 1961, and it was the 87th Congress in its first session, and on pages 122 and 125, I thought it would be good for me to read to you just a couple of thoughts that came from our Congress in 1961 about aging. This is how it begins, and I'm quoting that right here. And you can Google it yourself and find it, all right? Quote, "The meaning of life is to be found solely in man's relationship to God. It is this relationship which gives meaning to all human values. In the light of it, every period of life, including that of old age, is possessed of intrinsic value and sublime potential. Viewed in the light of eternal destiny, old age is seen to have an importance as great as that of youth or middle years." Are you stunned? Let me read two more sentences. This is under recommendations. "Our society, by reason of its preoccupation with frontier development and economic advance, has tended to glorify youth and denigrate old age. The time has come, I'm reading verbatim, the time has come to recognize that the cult of eternal youth is idolatry. So when I look at this here, I am saying to us, men and women, listen very carefully to me. I am saying that each category of people in the church has their place. And what is happening in the church is the 50 and up crowd is the crowd that the church is no longer going hard after, or they are going hard after the church. I've put my time in. I've had people say that to me. And I say to you, men and women, this is the time of your life that we need. You have got to invest your life, the rest of your life, into people. These are the years that, if I was to take the Hippocratic thought, these are the years that are the gairos. These are the additional, the bonus years of your life. So if God has bonus you with these years, then he's bonused you these years so that you might invest them for his glory. So let's bow our head. Let's close our eyes.